Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Giselle Yasmin, globally engaged researcher, speaker, executive, senior fellow, the UBC Institute of Asian Research. Giselle, you're just an amazing background, so thank you for sharing so much of your experiences and wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Stephen.
You know, Giselle, you just have such an amazing success, and congratulations on some of your most recent success. Can you talk about some of the upcoming projects you have, the value to stakeholders?
Yes, well, you know, I'm delighted to have come home to my old institute at UBC, the Institute of Asian Research, which is a real thrill after so many years away. But more recently, I was appointed incoming director of social protection for an international not-for-profit called WIGO, which stands for Women in Informal Employment, Globalizing and Organizing. And this also takes me back to my roots of working with microenterprises in the informal sector and connecting that with some of the leadership experience I've acquired over the years. So I'm really thrilled about that.
Now let's go into more of your life journey. Giselle, can you describe your journey of continuing enlightenment from age 4 to 18 and the milestones?
Well, I'm not sure how enlightened I am, but I've certainly had an interesting ride throughout my life. I was born and lived until age 6 in Montreal in a very multicultural, multilingual neighborhood. I think that shaped me extensively. And then when I was about 6, we moved to Western Canada and lived in all over Western Canada and even the Arctic, north of 60. So I've had a kind of range of experience in, you know, big cities, small towns, multicultural settings, lived with indigenous communities as well. I think that had a big impact on my upbringing and how I was raised. And I think it was a real privilege to be able to experience so many different parts of the world. As an adult, I traveled a lot as well and lived abroad. So I think that kind of makes me, I like to think of myself as a citizen of the world with a Canadian passport. So I think that's how my experience has sort of shaped my worldview.
Well, it sounds like, you know, with your kind of background, it'll make you quite inclusive and give you sort of a broad perspective, which helps shape your goals in your life. Now, how did your life change in university? And what were the milestones and what powerful lessons did you learn that continue to shape your vision into the future?
I think going to university, you know, it's one of those experiences where you really crystallize your worldview and your theories about the world, as well as acquire a kind of knowledge and skill base that can take you forward. I was very privileged. I started at University of Ottawa, and I don't know if you know University of Ottawa, but it's a bilingual university operating in both English and French. So as a Francophone raised outside of Quebec, before Francophones kind of had the institutions that we have today, that was a real opportunity. University of Ottawa, interestingly enough, was actually quite a technologically advanced campus as well, I must say. It was one of the early adopters of information technology for its library. You know, having said that, I'm not a spring chicken, so one of my early memories is, you know, my first experience of computing on an Amdahl computer and having to learn coding in the middle of the night to do simple word processing, the kind of thing that I think would make my son laugh these days. But I was privileged throughout my university career at University of Ottawa, McGill, and University of British Columbia to have some really outstanding mentors and professors. So I think that is really, I think I heard Mike Lazaridis say, you know, I know he was quoting someone, but the teacher lights the spark of knowledge. And so I think that's where I'm most grateful, is having had that mentorship and guidance and having worked with some really terrific colleagues.
Now we go on, and you've had this amazing career. You're also the senior fellow at the University of British Columbia Institute of Asian Research. In that work, can you describe some projects and lessons?
Yeah, I've had I've been doing a number of interesting projects through my appointment at the Institute. A couple are related to food security, which is an area where I've done a lot of work and feel very passionate about. So I've been involved with a couple of food international as well as more nationally focused food security projects. I've also been on the International Scientific Advisory Board for a Dutch computer science research program, which is actually quite interdisciplinary. Even though it's run out of computer science, it involves cultural institutions like libraries and museums, that involves researchers and other experts from outside of computer science, social sciences, humanities, and whatnot. So I'm off at the end of this week to the Netherlands for the final meeting of this project that I've been involved with for several years, which is really has been really a thrilling experience.
You're also the former vice president of research at the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, just a very prestigious group, Canadian federal government research granting agency. Can you describe some of your projects and lessons from that time there?
Absolutely. I was vice president of research, but I was also vice president of partnerships. My role evolved over 7 years. And I think it was a huge opportunity on a number of levels to work with our sister agencies. You may know NSERC, Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council, and the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. So to work with those sister agencies was a huge opportunity. But I feel that with the team, we also got to another level in terms of our partnership strategies, both as a research funding organization, but also building the capacity of the research community to engage itself in partnership activities. We also advanced a lot on what SHRC calls knowledge mobilization, which is creating value from knowledge. And I think, as you know, Stephen, we put a lot of effort into creating knowledge, but then how much effort do we put into preserving, conserving, disseminating, distributing, creating value, using that knowledge, et cetera? How do we extract and develop the maximum value from that knowledge? So those are areas where we really moved forward. We also, I think, did a number of very, very exciting projects, similar to the one that I'm involved with in the Netherlands, but one was called Digging into Data, which was on big data, which involved a number of international players from around the world, agencies from around the world, a number of disciplines from around the world, and it was really a leading edge initiative at the time when it was created, kind of an early example of that kind of work. The other things that we did were, and where I was particularly involved, was redoing our whole grant program architecture. So, how did we restructure our funding grants to make them into a more simplified, coherent set of offerings? And that was certainly a difficult project, and not without its kinks, but one that did garner us the IPAC Deloitte Leadership Award. So I think we were all very proud of that. And the final thing I would mention is that I had the opportunity to lead a futures or foresight exercise. And as an emerging technology person, Stephen, I'm sure you have a lot of experience with that, but for an agency like SHRC, it was a bit risky and not without its controversies. But to bring in that kind of futures orientation actually resulted in a well-established initiative, which is still ongoing at SHRC, called Imagining Canada's Future. So I think that really had an impact on me, but also I think had a deep impact on the research community and other partners across the public, private, not-for-profit sectors as well.
You know, such a rich background. Can you now detail your work managing research and related activities across the public, academic, and not-for-profit sectors?
I guess I sometimes say that I went to the dark side, you know, because when you go through more of an academic training and do a PhD, you're expected to go that traditional academic route. And I jumped into the more of an oversight role early in my career, working with wonderful people like John Robinson and Mike Harcourt and Ann Dale at the Sustainable Development Research Institute at UBC. I was then recruited as the founding regional director of the Center for Research and Information on Canada's first office for BC and the Yukon. That was, again, a huge opportunity to oversee regional research and research activities and related activities, but also take part in national dialogues. Then I got recruited to oversee all the research and outreach and parliamentary affairs activities for Elections Canada, as well as communications work. That was quite a place to cut one's teeth. It was a minority government at the time. It was a very sort of stressful experience, but rewarding nevertheless, and really at the heart of our democratic and political processes. So I really treasure that experience. Then I was recruited into SHRC, as I mentioned, Vice President of Partnerships and then Research, and now back at the Institute, but more recently incoming Director of Social Protection at WECO, as I mentioned.
Again, I'm just simply amazed at the number of contributions you've made to the country, but also to the world. And I personally consider you one of the top experts out there, and just an amazing journey you've been on. You've also done quite a bit of publishing. Can you talk about that work and lessons to be shared?
Yeah, I guess I am a bit of a writer by nature. I've done a bit of radio, a tiny bit of television as well, but my medium is more writing. I would not consider myself an outstanding writer by any means, but I have published both on the scholarly side, but more recently over the last, say, 10 years or more, 10, 15 years, I've really taken an interest in open access publishing. One, I think, of the big challenges in our society is that there's great work that's done that's not actually accessible to audiences. And with the whole digital revolution, we have a real opportunity to make knowledge and other publications available to a much, much wider audience. So I've been very involved in the open access movement in terms of my own publishing, and I've also done a lot of op-eds and shorter opinion pieces. And I find, I don't know if you agree, Stephen, but in this day and age, it's really hard to capture the attention of an audience. And how do you, long, complex texts, though they're still very necessary, if you limit yourself to that, you're not going to be able to reach as many people. So the long, complex texts need to be complemented by short pieces that draw an audience in. So I certainly have been working a lot more on that front to try to consolidate some of the work I've done and make it more broadly accessible. And I like podcasts too, so thank you.
Such a rich background in media. You also have considerable linguistic skills. Again, such a eclectic, multi-talented person. Can you describe some of the languages you speak and how this came about?
Well, the only languages I speak totally, totally fluently are English and French. That has been, as I mentioned, a bit of a life project, because when I was raised in Western Canada, Francophones did not have their own schools yet. In fact, there wasn't even immersion, which tends to be oriented towards Anglophones who want to learn French. So I spent many, many years perfecting my French, maybe 10 years, and to the point where I am now able to, correct other people, both in writing and otherwise. But English and French are my strongholds. But I have also studied Urdu, which is like Hindi. I've studied Thai. I was fairly fluent in Thai because I lived back and forth in Thailand for about 10 years, both during and after my PhD. I've studied Spanish, tiny bit of Italian, I wouldn't really count it, and I've more recently been studying Mandarin, which I have really, really been enjoying, especially since I'm back on the West Coast, and you can practice regularly, including listening to radio and whatnot, and I find that the background in Thai, there are some similarities in terms of grammar, and some of the concepts, measure words and classifiers and that kind of thing. One of the things I'm excited about with my new involvement with WeGo, because we do a lot of work in Spanish and an opportunity to work on my Spanish. So I'm very much looking forward to that. But my advice to young people, and I wish I had done more when I was younger, but is, you know, start as early as possible learning as many languages as you can. As the older you get, the harder it is. And the more languages you know, the easier it is to acquire others. So my advice to young people is always, you're never wasting your time when you're learning other languages. It's like having another life.
You know, Mandarin is tonal in nature. You're saying that doesn't create a challenge?
It does create a challenge. I mean, first of all, I'm not a spring chicken anymore, so my memory is not what it used to be. I'm very much a beginner. I try to practice as much as I can. I've only been studying for about a year and a half, so I'm by no means, you know, I have emergency Mandarin, and I'm able to carry on very simple conversations, almost like a young child. But you have to start somewhere. I have not attacked this script at all because it's just too challenging. I'm just limiting myself to pinyin right now. But the beauty of, again, living in a place like Vancouver is that you take the SkyTrain and you hear Mandarin on the SkyTrain. And so I'm taking it as a learning opportunity. I don't expect to ever get necessarily to a high level of fluency, although you never know, depends how much effort I put into it. But I'm just finding that it's a wonderfully logical language and has a beautiful grammatical simplicity, which I love. So, you know, it's a recent project, a small part of my life, but one that I do want to keep working on bit by bit.
About a week ago, I was asked to do some impromptu speaking at a conference at CES, and I sort of did a rapid calculation in my head, and I was thinking roughly each person on the planet probably has 10 ideas a day. And if you multiply that over a decade, that works out to probably be about 20 trillion ideas in a decade. And out of that, and out of those 20 trillion ideas, you get something like a Google, or you get a Microsoft, or an IBM, or you get Facebook or WhatsApp and so on. But it also speaks to awards as well. There's so many people on the planet, but only a few get awards. Or there's so many people with PhDs, but only a few get awards. And that's a really mark of distinction and outstanding execution. And you've won many awards. Can you talk about your journey into these awards?
I don't feel like I've had that many awards, but the few that stand out in my mind, I already mentioned one, and that was more of a team award. The IPAC Beloit Leadership Award for the work at SHRC on its grant program architecture renewal, in which I was highly involved because I had responsibility for the grants for quite a few years. But earlier in my career, you know, I did benefit from a few awards related to my studies, an honorable mention of the Usha Mahajani Prize at the PhD level, at the master's level, the John Bradbury Award, and then a number of scholarships. I felt very fortunate to have all of my graduate work funded through scholarships and fellowships. The IDRC, International Development Research Center, Young Canadian Researchers Award, a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, PhD fellowship and whatnot. So I'm not sure that's really that special or unusual, but I certainly felt very fortunate to have that kind of support and recognition early in my career, as well as a few instances later.
As a very diverse and multi-talented person, you have many roles and almost like separate lifetimes in different areas of the and different domains, and one of which is in the academic side. Can you talk about some of the journey points in that academic side and lessons?
Certainly. Well, the joke that it's not exactly a joke. I think it's true. I think the academic community considers me too non-academic, and the non-academic community considers me too academic. So I guess I've always been on the cusp of academe as well as the public-private not-for-profit sectors, which in some ways makes me a little bit of a misfit, but in other ways positions me in interesting ways for where I think a lot of post-secondary institutions are going, which is how do you connect the academic world with the broader with broader society, and how do you build those connections and develop those skills. So I have by no means had a typical academic career. I had the option. I did have offers of the tenure track, but I had other interesting offers at the same time, which ended up shaping my career path. So I did take a different journey forward, as I mentioned, into research oversight, administration, executive type functions. Recently I was asked, there's a new UBC program called the Masters in Public Policy and Global Affairs, and I was one of the speakers invited to talk to the young people in that first cohort. And I said, well, why are you inviting me to speak to this group? And they said, well, you're a real person who's gone out there and done all sorts of interesting things. So I said, okay, I'll talk to them about my career path. So again, I'm not, I haven't had a typical journey. Some see that as a good thing. Others see it as a little bit unusual and aren't quite sure what to do with it. But my space is on that cusp of academe and the public-private and not-for-profit sectors.
I work with many entrepreneurs, and in fact, some noted entrepreneurs who've had years of success. And one of the things that is common amongst these entrepreneurs is this sort of diversity of backgrounds, very much like yourself. And so you'd be and are an outstanding entrepreneur, I think, in my opinion. So now, can you describe some megatrends and how they will shape our world and our destiny?
Yeah, I'm very interested in this. And you know, I was very influenced by, as I mentioned, the Foresight Future work that we did when I was at SHRC a few years ago. And the ones that I would mention, first is global population aging, which is huge, and we're starting to finally talk about it, but we're moving towards a planet of elderly people with low birth rates, and that applies around the world. I mean, even sub-Saharan Africa is slowing down, and sub-Saharan Africa, you know, the typical demographic was 6 children per woman. And as Africa, as the growth rates, you know, as it grows economically, that is slowing down. So I think this is something we're not really ready for. It's a huge, 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 huge transition. And so that's a first one. Obviously, emerging technologies, and, you know, you're deeply familiar with that area. Not just digital, but life sciences, and there's a bit of an overlap there as well. I heard it said at a conference, I mean, this is not my thing, I don't know who this is attributed to, but we live in a society where we have human beings who evolved in the Stone Age, our institutions are medieval or 19th century at best, and we have godlike technology. And that's the conundrum we find ourselves in the 21st century. So the emerging technologies are just actually scary and exciting at the same time. And obviously there's a lot of discussion of that, but how do we adapt, and how do we, technology should be a tool. It should be serving us, not vice versa. So there's some concern about where that might be going. The global centers of power, it took a long time for us all to wake up to the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Some of those economies, including China, are now slowing down. So there are other parts of the world that are emerging, you know, Mexico, Turkey, Indonesia, et cetera. So we have to keep an eye on those emerging economies, and it's not necessarily a Western-led, center of gravity is not necessarily in the Western countries anymore, and we have to really, I think, wake up to that. There's a few others, too, that I would mention, and that's our whole, something we don't talk about very much, but our values and, you know, different kinds of societal values that are sort of competing for attention. And I think there was an assumption that, you know, societies would somehow evolve and grow and develop and adopt certain Western Enlightenment values. And I think there are a lot of people who are saying, well, it's not necessarily the case. So how do we get along, you know, nonviolently in a world where there are maybe contradictory or conflicting sets of values and cultural norms and expectations? So those are just a few that I would mention, and it is a bit of a complex mix.
Yeah, definitely a very amazing times that we're living in, and you know, all of these different concepts, like, you know, the singularity or the disruption of artificial intelligence and the impact it's going to have on us from a culture, economic, and social standpoint, and just so many different forces, or CRISPR-Cas9 in the genetic editing area, and what does that mean in terms of our human genome? I mean, just it's kind of scary and exciting at the same time, and it's interesting. Now, you know, a big part of our audience are ICT executives, so how do you think they can act on your predictions?
Well, I don't know if I have really predictions. I mean, I don't really believe in the concept of predictions, but there are, let's say, issues that are preoccupying me and where we all, I think, have to get out of our comfort zones and challenge ourselves to think a bit differently than we normally do. But I think I've worked with a lot of ICT executives, and I'm wondering if one of our challenges is we need highly specialized people who are trained in, you know, the depth of all of these emerging technologies from a purely technical standpoint. But what I've also noticed is the success of new training programs that combine, for example, computer science and IT with business and humanities and creative arts and whatnot. So cross-training the younger generation so that you don't end up with as many silos in, you know, professional environments where you have the business trying to communicate with IT and they don't really understand each other. The IT people are very technologically savvy but don't necessarily understand the business, and the business doesn't really understand the potential of the technology. So I'm hoping with the younger generation growing up more digitally literate and whatnot, that we can have more, it's a bit like bilingualism, you know, people who are comfortable in various environments. And there's all these movements now of kids learning how to do coding and whatnot. And I think that's just hugely, hugely important. The other thing I'm really interested in is, you know, where, you know, again, as I mentioned before, where is all this going and how do we maximize these tools for our benefit and for, you know, to make our lives better and easier, to improve well-being for people around the world? Because all of these technologies have a dark side too, and we know that, and they can be used for harm. So how do we maximize, you know, the potential for positive global change with the use of these technologies? So we really need those ICT executives to help us through that process.
Giselle, you have so many different kinds of interests, and I sometimes wonder what things continue to excite you.
You know, there are a couple of things that I want to mention. And I must say one of my favorite and most challenging jobs is being a mother. And the privilege of watching a healthy, intelligent child grow from, you know, day one, and the wonder of all that, and how a person, watching my son grow and develop, I never thought I'd say this. I mean, I never thought of myself as, you know, mama material, and but watching my son acquire new knowledge and skills and find his own place in the world, but just it never ceases to amaze me. And you know, in spite of whatever my parenting skills or my husband, we do our best, but they manage to craft their own little niche. And his unbelievable skills, I mean, I know you're technology focused, even professional IT people end up having their kids deal with the technology because it's just changed so fast. And so the same is in our household. If anything needs fixing, it's our 12-year-old son who's doing it. So that's one thing. Meeting a new and interesting people every day. You know, I think that's one of my goals, is to meet and talk to a new interesting person, if not every day, at least once a week. And that really keeps me going. I love people's life stories, and I kind of collect that. And the third thing I would mention is setting goals and meeting them, setting realistic goals and meeting them, both for yourself, for your career, for your family. I guess it's like a little mini strategic planning exercise. And when you're able to tick off that goal as done, it's just hugely satisfying. Whether it's, you know, I don't know, losing weight or finding that ideal job or contract or, you know, trying to make sure someone in your life stays healthy, et cetera. So I think those are kind of that's what kind of keeps me going. I'm very positive. I believe in having a glass half full point of view. And that's what kind of keeps me going every day.
Giselle, you have this history of strong leadership, in fact, outstanding leadership, in my opinion. So what makes a great executive, or what makes a great leader? And as a successful executive or leader, what do you see are the best leadership lessons that can be used by executives?
I think, you know, leadership, there's been a lot written since ancient times about leadership and what it means. And I think that there can be various leadership styles, and they're all legitimate. I think the most important thing is to know yourself as a leader, is to constantly try to understand yourself and your own motivations and how other people perceive you compared to how you perceive yourself and how you might be perceived by various audiences, because it can change. And understanding what motivates other people, and how that it's not necessarily about pleasing people, it's about doing the right thing. So there are moments where doing the right thing and doing things right. So there are times where, you know, people might be not too happy with you or upset, but you have to feel that you're doing your best to do the right thing and to do it right, and to put people first. But that doesn't necessarily mean making everybody happy all of the time. It's a bit like parenting. I mean, raising your child effectively is not about giving in to everything they want. Sometimes you have to say no. You know, you can't keep playing that video game. You've had enough. Or you must eat such and such because you can't, you know, you have to be healthy, etc. So how do you also make it self-motivating for the people you're working with? How do you empower them and create conditions so that they exercise their own leadership? Because at the end of the day, I think leadership is about creating other leaders. It's about service and creating leadership capacity in others.
You know, that's a great lesson to pass on in terms of empowering others to be leaders. And that, in essence, makes you a better leader. So that's a great idea and a great executable concept to pass on to the audience. You know, as I mentioned, that when you examine your background, it's covers so many different domains and areas, and you've excelled at so many of them. And I said that's the mark of an entrepreneur or an innovator. So this gets to this idea of agility. You know, it's a key idea today when working with startups or launching new product or services. even within a larger enterprise. And in fact, enterprises today are borrowing from or learning from all of the concepts that are involved with startups. So what are the key steps, in your opinion, from, you know, working as an innovator, being interested in, I think, in entrepreneurship? What are some of the key steps that enterprises can use for producing innovation to keep them competitive?
Yeah, and I do think of myself as a bit of an ersatz entrepreneur and innovator who's done a lot of work in startups. In fact, a lot of my jobs and assignments have been startup oriented. So either starting up a completely new venture or reorienting, like starting a new phase in the development of an organization or a program, et cetera. So I do identify with that. I think there are a couple things. I think you have to be able to read your environment. So you have to be able to read your environment and understand what's going on. So there's this ability to assimilate a number of complex streams of information and say, okay, here's what's going on in the environment, and here's where we are in terms of timing. You know, what is the environment ready for? I think something about startups and entrepreneurships and innovation is you also have to be willing to get your hands dirty. You know, when you're starting up a new venture, you don't necessarily have the muscle and the soldiers in place to, you know, it's not a Fortune 500 kind of environment. So you have to be willing to get down there and get your hands dirty and understand all steps of the business process as well. Because if you're going to grow whatever venture or enterprise it is, you have to understand in a very deep and hands-on way, you know, the devil in the details. And there are too many out there who, they want the job and the title, but they don't, you know, they're not very competent because they don't really understand the business, or they don't want to get their hands dirty and they miss out on the details. So this is, I think, a bit of a fatal flaw. So I think the best, the most competent startup entrepreneurs, no matter what the area, are those who are able to combine those skills of reading their environment and getting their hands dirty and understanding both the high level and the details of what it is they're involved in.
And then as an extension to that question, what do you see as the key attributes in individuals or teams that produces winning products and services?
I think there are a couple of things, Stephen. One is persistence. I mean, you can't be daunted by setbacks and failures. You have to be motivated to go on and to, you know, tackle those obstacles. So persistence, sort of, you know, being able to soldier on is an absolutely essential feature. But the other, and I think we tend to underestimate it, is storytelling. You know, how do you put together a compelling narrative that can motivate people to persist and to keep on? You know, my former boss, Chad Gaffield, was president of Shirk, and he's actually quite a figure in the digital world, a pioneer as well, said, you know, it's a bit like, you know, how do you get the sweeper to feel that they're helping build the space station, right? So you need a compelling, simple narrative that inspires and motivates people, but that also helps them understand the value of what it is they are creating. Because we're all creating value of some sort, no matter what line of business or activities we're in, whether you're in the public, private, or not-for-profit sectors. So what value are you creating? What's your value proposition? How do you articulate that simply for various audiences internally and externally? And you have to be able to say it in a manner that people understand. So I think those are some of the key skills, meaning-making, but also, you know, making sure that the troops are, let's say, motivated and have the energy and resources to give their very best.
And to kind of round out the questions then, how do you know when you have a winning product or service?
Well, you know, I think... It's not a simple thing, and it can take years. But if you are creating value, and if you've read your environment, then, you know, you will eventually be successful and thrive. So those, I think, are the indicators. You know, and that's, I think, the beauty of a true, I don't know to what extent we are in a true free market, but, you know, at the end of the day, individuals, organizations will come forward when they see something of value. I mean, look at this whole B2B movement. It's huge. It's huge. This is transforming, you know, the whole personalization, whether it's Airbnb, vacation rental by owner, or HomeAway. There's so many of these services. They're shaking up all our institutions, Uber, et cetera. This idea that there's a little free market out there, and individuals are and organizations are offering something, and there's someone there who's willing to take it up. These B2B services are sprouting up everywhere. We're not at all ready to deal with it from a regulatory point of view, but yet it's there, and it's just, you know, taking off. So that's a sign that I think society wants that kind of flexibility. You know, am I going to be able to, when I run out of eggs, you know, go to a neighbor and just buy eggs? You know, I don't know. I mean, how that's going to work. So I think that's, you know, you know because you end up being successful, and then there's points where you go out of business, and is it because your time is up, or you're ahead of your time, or there's been some kind of flaw? I mean, there are winners and there are losers. So I think by creating that value at the right time, you know, there is potential for success. But of course, you can't be successful all the time. We learn a lot from our failures too.
Giselle, I guess you're really sort of highlighting the sharing and sometimes caring economy, as evidenced by Uber and Airbnb and others. And sometimes it's referred to as O2O, that is online to offline. And as you indicated, everybody has something they can share with others, and perhaps there can be some kind of a value exchange, or everybody wins. It's an amazing time we live in, and it's you're part of that as an entrepreneur and innovator as well. So we're going to go a little bit off, maybe an outlier question from your standpoint, but it's one that's of interest to the computing community. So, you know, we have people in different professions like medicine and law and engineering and accounting, and even things like plumbing and hairdressing. They're all licensed or regulated in some way. Do you think that computing should be a recognized profession on par with some of the others, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and perhaps this is the most sort of controversial side, recognized credentials?
You know, in many ways, yes, without necessarily the rigidity. I mean, some of the, you know, how do you organize professions effectively? Sometimes professional regulatory bodies, I mean, they play a hugely important role, but they can also be quite rigid in terms of allowing, you know, credentials recognition and whatnot. If you look at, you know, immigrants, for example, coming from other countries, one of the stumbling blocks is, you know, to what extent are their credentials recognized? How can you, maybe computer science should be at the vanguard of a new model of, professional recognition, you know, by virtue of the fact that everything changes so fast in computer science. So maybe that's, I think, one of the challenges, is how do you take the best of what's happened in that regulatory environment for other professions, but take it to a different level, take it to a new level, and make it sort of supple, yet build in the kind of safeguards that are in place for other professions. Having said that, I think you need something for specialists, but we also need more cross-training, as I mentioned. So we need a broader digital literacy, it's a bit like reading, writing, arithmetic, you know, I mean, those basic skills, basic computing skills need to be at the heart of our whole educational enterprise. So I think there's that side of it as well. But I don't know much about this, Stephen, but I would be very curious to know where those discussions are at, because I think it would be a mistake to go turn back the clock. I think you would want to leapfrog a little bit. in terms of whatever regulatory bodies are put in place that recognize the fast-changing nature of your business.
Yeah, when you consider this idea of professionalism, the concept of professionalism embodies ideas like professional development, code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and so on. And I would say that you've outlined your views quite well in terms of professionalism and, you know, some of the pros and cons of it as well. How about ethics itself as be part of this professionalism term? You know, you have things like Dieselgate, you know, the sort of the softer issues or some of the hacking that's occurred. Do you have any recommendations on the ethical front?
Yeah, I think that's a broader social issue. You know, I mean, I don't think it's limited to technology. It's worrisome. Again, values and ethics. I mean, it's at the heart of how our societies are supposed to work and how we're supposed to raise our kids and educate our children, both at home and in institutional educational environments. And, I mean, there are always going to be outliers who don't adhere to the kind of ethical and values frameworks. But, again, do we talk about it enough as a society, never mind in technology circles? Do we talk enough about ethical issues and what's right and wrong? And, you know, I don't want to be nostalgic or anything, but, you know, when my grandfather, my maternal grandfather did business, he did it on a handshake, right? His word and his handshake was a contract. It was worth everything, his reputation and whatnot. So, you know, to what extent are we raising our children and ourselves to have those kind of deep ethical values that, you know, they know the limits between right and wrong and you know, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. So I think there's a broader social dialogue here. Technology has its own specific issues, but it's a broader concern, and we have to talk about it, I think, as a society and decide where we set our boundaries.
And then to sort of round out this sort of series of questions, do you see or feel that there are areas related to computing in terms of policy discussion that you want to bring up?
Yeah, I think there's a couple. I mean, the user perspective, on two levels. I mean, on the one hand, you've got highly specialized people trying to help individuals who are not highly technically competent do their work. So the perspective of the user, but also what's the knowledge base of the user? What does the user think is possible technologically? How do you move beyond the flat file, as people have said? So there's that dialogue, which is actually quite difficult. But the other is user-generated content. So we're all kind of part of this equation now, you know, generating our own or, you know, being very proactive and creating our own digital content. So how do we bring in those various perspectives, and how do we evaluate that work? It's certainly, I think, opening a lot of doors for a lot of people, but then there's also a question of curation and, you know, what is quality? How do you evaluate the quality of some of the user-generated content that's being developed? The other is multidisciplinarity, and I think that's what's so exciting about the work I'm doing in the Netherlands for this final meeting next week is, you know, how do you bring in experts from various disciplines, not just computer science, but other fields as well, and non-academic participants as well, into this whole question of, you know, having information technology benefit as many individuals and organizations as possible. So the multidisciplinarity is really, really important. And I think the other is the gender component. For some reason, in Western society, it's not the case in Asia or Eastern Europe, but in North America, at least, maybe parts of Western Europe, technology's been seen as a guy thing. I don't know why, but anyway, it's not like that in other parts of the world. So, you know, how do we get more women and girls interested? And, you know, I think it's also related to, I look at my son and the whole video game world. They say more and more girls are playing video games and women. But, you know, the content, I don't know. I mean, there's something that needs to be done there to make it a little more holistic and inclusive. So I think we need to look at that.
You know, just a fascinating perspective that you bring to these discussions, and very much sort of spotlights the diversity, as I mentioned, of your background and the excellence that you've accomplished in so many different areas. Can you maybe now, you know, sort of discuss some of the major challenges that you've faced in your life and how you're able to master them? And I think there's some important lessons there or gems that would be uncovered.
Well, I mean, I've been in a lot of professional positions where I've been told I was set up for failure. And I kind of, you know, it was a little scary to hear that, but somehow persisted and managed to follow through and, you know, land the files nevertheless. So I think sometimes you end up in a professional situation where you're given discouraging messages, and you have to be able to look beyond that and muster up, you know, your courage and your persistence to move forward. So I don't want to name any specific examples, but certainly I've had a number of challenges in professional environments. And, you know, I talked about working with some fantastic supportive people, and certainly I have, but, you know, we've all worked with difficult or incompetent colleagues as well, and you have to find ways around that. But I think the fact that I grew up in so many different kinds of environments and, you know, moved around a lot and had to learn to adapt also gave me a certain flexibility and suppleness as opposed to a rigidity that might have resulted in, you know, some cracks showing up. So I think every challenge you go through, it's a bit like Nietzsche said, that makes you stronger. So I had a number of both personal and professional situations where I've sort of managed to get beyond that. I think you need to also give yourself sources of strength and spiritual fortitude. So, you know, a few close friends you can count on, your supportive, you know, mentors and parents and older generations who are there to support you, and also some health and spiritual practices that give you the resolve to and the energy to carry on. I like to also remember some of the stories. My mother is a nurse, so I grew up with a lot of life and death stories from her nursing background, and that always used to help me put things into perspective, where you stop sweating the small stuff, and you sit back and you say, is this a life or death situation? No. And then you basically put it into perspective, and you evaluate, okay, this is not a huge drama. Let's, you know, let it settle and move beyond it. So I think having grown up with a mother who worked in that kind of environment and sharing those stories with me helps, you know, put various issues into perspective. Let's face it, I live a comfortable life, and I have, you know, the basic necessities of life, and I think working now with WeGo is going to, it also helps underscore that so many around the world, including in Canada, don't have the basic necessities, and so let's put our issues into perspective and appreciate what we have and move forward together collectively.
Just now we're down to our last few questions, and you know, we're going to get maybe perhaps broader. You know, you have so many interests. Do you have any area that you want to sort of talk about further in terms of your interests? And then in addition to that, if I were to give you sort of an open canvas, are there any broader challenges that you feel you want to talk about and sort of address and maybe even propose some solutions?
Well, I don't think there are easy solutions out there, but I think there are a few key issues we might want to talk about collectively. You know, one that really preoccupies me is that we live in a world of abundance, yet so many go without. I mean, let's face it, most of us in Canada are flushing our toilets with drinking water, okay? And much of the world, including a few parts of Canada and individuals in Canada, actually don't even have, you know, sanitation and safe drinking water. I mean, that's a preoccupation. We have enough food to feed every man, woman, and child on this planet quite comfortably. It's a question of access, distribution. There are questions of waste, too. We don't talk much about waste. We create a lot, and then we don't put efforts into conserving, preserving, whether it's food or knowledge or, you know, et cetera. We need to put a more emphasis on how do we prevent, how do we tread lightly on the earth, but also minimize waste and make more effective use of the resources we have. And how do we, you know, learn to get along with each other despite our differences? So whether it's our own training or backgrounds or cultural influences or language skills, et cetera, or values, how do we get along nonviolently? And we're seeing more and more issues crop up around the world. You know, how do we get beyond that and move forward? So those are kind of the issues that really preoccupy me. How do we become more inclusive? And how do we think globally, act locally?
You know, it's interesting. I guess those are very much aligned with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, the goals of, in terms of solving all of these critical issues for all the countries in the world to be from now, I guess, or I guess ratified in 2015 going to 2030. And some very big issues, but it's interesting that they realize now technology is a key part of resolving all of these problems, whereas with the Millennium Development Goals, there wasn't that realization. But surely technology is going to play a big part.
And they're global, too. That's what's nice about the SDGs is they're global. They're for everybody. Yeah,
exactly. Well, we're down to our last two questions, and that is you do so much speaking and traveling, and I know you've come across some really interesting stuff or stories and so on. Are there any that you want to share? Maybe something amusing or surprising, unexpected?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a joke. You know, my husband always laughs. I have this strange pattern in my life that I run into people in the most unusual places that I know. So, you know, I'll be in Bangkok, a city of more than 10 million people, and I'll be on the SkyTrain, and all of a sudden I'll hear someone call my name, you know, a friend from some distant part of the world, you know, just happen to run into them. There are other stories, too, you know, being in southern India and, you know, meeting with the trade office. This was quite a few years ago, and my husband and I weren't married yet. We were engaged, and this fellow in the trade office starts telling me about his friend in Canada, and he shows me a picture, and I said, oh my God, that's my fiance's cousin. So, you know, it's constantly happening to me. It's just too bizarre. I was on the phone the other day with someone, and he knew I was going to South Africa, and he said, oh, do you know so-and-so? I said, oh my God, I met her 25 years ago. She's in South Africa now? So it you know, goes on and on and on. I just don't know it's very strange, but it's a lot of fun as well. So this kind of happens to me all the time. And I always see it as it's a bit like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You know, it's one of these signs that something must be going right.
Well, Giselle, it definitely sounds like you have, it's not 6 degrees of separation. It sounds like you're connected to everybody with 2 degrees or 3 degrees of separation.
Absolutely. We probably know a few people in common as well if we dig deep enough.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, you can prove that by number theory, by the way.
Okay.
So, you know, we're down to our last question now. And if you were conducting this interview, so I'm kind of turning the tables. If you were conducting this interview, what three questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I would ask, particularly someone like you, Stephen, you know, the difference between theory and practice. I mean, when it comes to technology, there's always this amazing potential. But at the end of the day, you got to get people to do stuff. I mean, it's easier said than done. And so where is that disconnect between theory and practice? And, you know, I think we've all lived that. That would be one thing. The second is the fragility of technology. Like, you know, we can regress easily. You know, some ancient civilizations had really advanced technology, and then those societies collapsed, and we all forgot about it. And then we had to literally come back and reinvent the wheel. So how do we recognize that fragility of technology, and you know, make sure, kind of like when the Alexandria Library burned down, that we don't all, you know, spin out into the Dark Ages again. And thirdly, yeah, the dark side of technology. I mean, in my youth, I read a lot of work by someone named Heather Menzies. Actually, apparently the Scottish pronunciation is Mingus, but no one says it that way. So she wrote a lot on the dark side of technology. It really influenced me, because we always think of the panacea, but there's also dystopic and dark elements. And so how do we grapple with that? And if you look at a lot of science fiction coming out and films and video games, a lot of it is about that dark side. So there's something going on there, and how do we, you know, reconcile that and try to avoid those issues?
You know, just reading a piece today in terms of the dark side, and, you know, as you know, Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and Bill Joy, I mean, there's just so many have come out, including the Future of Life Institute and thousands of scientists at one of the largest AI conference last year in terms of AI, automated drones, the threat to humanity, to our species. And then, so there's this kind of idea of rapid evolution of machine learning and what impact that will have. And on the other side, there's this sort of rapid evolution of carbon-based life because of CRISPR-Cas9 or CPF1, this kind of new gene editing technology, and what impact will that have? So silicon versus carbon, and who will win out?
Or some combination.
yeah, exactly. Hybrids, like the work that DARPA is doing, where they are producing hybrids, right? So people-machine combinations, yeah. You know, Giselle, it's been a fascinating journey. You're just such an amazing person, and I know your schedule is demanding, so thank you for coming in today and sharing so much of your insights and your wisdom with our audience.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Giselle Yasmin, globally engaged researcher, speaker, executive, senior fellow, UBC Institute of Asian Research.